This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Ceramics Association. For further information, please go to www.australianceramics.com.
Janet, maybe we could start with you having letting us know a little bit what you think about this notion of distributed studio and what it means.
I was looking for models that might actually fit what a change that was already happening in ceramics. And it seemed to me there were an increasing number of possibilities, modes of learning that were becoming available. We were running a distance course at the time from ANU, but I knew people who had private studios where they were bringing people in to learn ceramics. And there had been a mass closure of courses in the tertiary sector, both the tertiary and the vocational sector. And so there needed to be something else to fill what was becoming a bit of a void in that area. And it seemed to me that there was a possibility that you could actually piece together your ceramic education in a way that was not like the more traditional immersion courses.
And so in some ways, Jane, that led to the Slow Clay Centre.
Well, I didn't realise at the time that it did. I was very naive, perhaps, because I thought I was just responding to demand and expanding what had been a studio teaching practice for many, many years. And over those years, an increasing demand was happening for my teaching. So one day when I looked at the waiting list and realised there were 250 people on it, I thought, what do I need to do to satisfy this demand? Mm. Okay, maybe we need to get a building and rent it and employ people. And so subsequently, that's what we did. We were very, very concerned. I was very concerned about the closures that were still happening in 2012 when we opened Slow Clay. Within a month of opening Slow Clay, we lost our last TAFE college. It was announced that Holmes Glen TAFE would close. And I felt really uncomfortable because it looked like I was being opportunistic by opening Slow Clay. And I didn't want people to think that because it certainly wasn't on my mind. I'd always fed those institutions with students and I wanted them to continue. And I never ever planned to fill those gaps. I couldn't. You know, we have a small space and small equipment. So, yes, it might have led to it, but not consciously.
Sure. But it's not an either-or thing either, because the universities have also changed in that time in the way that they approach teaching fine art. Janet, can you say a bit about what you think is happening in those universities and in those changes?
I would say that it's fairly clear that we have moved almost totally to a liberal arts undergraduate degree model, which is like the American model where you can do electives in ceramics. You can even do a major in ceramics, but you don't have the 5 days a week immersion kind of course that used to be available in tertiary institutions. And what happens in the States is that the professional practice comes in at the master's degree level. Nobody who's serious about ceramics in the States doesn't do a master's degree. So it's effectively a five-year course that they do. And quite often to get into the institution of their choice for their master's degree, they'll do a special year in between as a kind of qualifying year. So effectively a six-year course, which is, I remember proposing at one stage to ANU, a six-year course rather than moving to a three-year one.
Yeah. And do you think that system has advantages, that change?
I do. I think it has advantages, but I think that you lose those advantages when you don't jump fairly quickly and take advantage of what's already existing in the institution. So in an institution like ANU, which has got a very strong prehistory, anthropology, archaeology, very strong departments in that area, you could have combined courses and suggested combinations of courses that could have trained people for jobs in the museum sector or jobs in industry or as archaeologists who knew about materials. We had one student who went on to engineering because his particular interest was clay bodies, and he ended up doing his master's degree and then a PhD in materials engineering, clay-based materials. But I think you can suggest those courses at the beginning rather than leave students to find their own way.
But Jane, that's different for people coming to a private school because they are choosing what they purchase, what pathway they take. Do you notice that in the people who come to you, and how do they then put together, you know, a solid experience that they can market in some way, you know, as for jobs and opportunities?
It's still a market in universities. They pay quite a lot more.
Sure.
and I think with us, we start from a popular roots basis and filter up. So we have had, right from the beginning, we've had students who've put their hands up to do more intensive training as starting as interns and then moving on to becoming technicians. We originally only had a role for one technician. We've now got five technicians working. We're sharing that job one session a week for each of them. So we're effectively training five people. What we have done is some of those people have moved on, started their own businesses. Some of them are even teaching at Slow Clay back again because I know them so well and I know they know our methods so well that they can teach them very, very well. And they're establishing their careers, you know, they're emerging practitioners. Some of them have gone on to work for other potters in that sort of studio technician role as well. So I feel we are sort of feeding that industry too still.
But even the way people market themselves and sell their work has changed, hasn't it? So as well as the distributed studio, there's a kind of distributed market now, isn't there?
Mm. Yes, it ballooned in a way that I don't think I'd ever comprehended. In some respects, taken the place of the small markets that we used to participate in back in the 60s, 70s and into the 80s, the craft fairs and things like that that used to happen. Although some of those are still extant and growing.
Big design market, yes. Finders keepers.
Yes, yes.
Big markets.
It's really just changed the role of galleries in a way, I think.
It's
at that end of the pathway.
Yes, it's made it difficult for the smaller galleries that are not representing, you know, a stable of artists.
Mm. Where people can earn, sell their work and not have to rely on paying a commission to someone in order to get that to happen.
Yes.
And so that takes away the earning capacity for the gallery.
Yes, because the major commercial galleries, the commission that they charge on work is substantial. You know, it's much more than used to be charged by small craft galleries in the past. But then they earn their money if they're good. And the best of them, you wouldn't be without them.
And I do know a couple of very good potters in Melbourne who've given up selling wholesale to shops and galleries and doing it, and they're doing it all this themselves on with their online shops.
Yes.
I'm not sure exactly how well they're doing, but it's certainly a move that they're testing now.
Yes. Well, it's a different notion of a career as a maker, isn't it? It's different. It changes that notion or broadens the notion of a career as a maker. Mm. I think.
Mm. Yeah, and I've been contacted by galleries in the States who want to carry certain of my work, you know, the functional porcelain work, and they have a very, very big online presence. You know, it's a large part of their selling. And they talk about how well the work would sit alongside and name other artists. So they're looking at it as two-dimensional images as much as they're looking at it as three-dimensional.
How they can market it two-dimensionally.
Yes, mm. Yeah. Mm.
I suppose one of the other themes that came up was that there are more options now and even pressure for people to self-direct in terms of their learning. And I wonder what you think the role of our institutions might be in helping people navigate.
There remains at base an accrediting role for institutions, but of course you don't need to have institutions in every small city or multitudes of them in capital cities to do that. And it may well be that the kind of accrediting that you want might be done by vocational training organisations. And just as you have to get certificates for working with children, certificates for working with vulnerable people, health and safety, you know, first aid certificates to be able to work in certain areas, then perhaps you can have similar sorts of courses for ceramic enterprises. And you can also perhaps have an accrediting body for quality of tableware or something like that that works a little bit like the wool mark.
I think one interesting move that we've been talking about is a local private and independent art college, which has existed for many, many years in Melbourne, and they've got a very solid reputation and do accreditation and diploma courses at least. We're talking about the ways that we can possibly join up under their umbrella so that we just make sure our teachers get the Cert 4 training, but that they provide all the accreditation and the other things. So they'll feed students to us to come and do the ceramics component of their visual arts diplomas, but also equally our students can access their other teachers in various things like drawing and design. And I think it's not under the same roof, it's not in the same building, but it's in the same suburb, and we've got a close relationship with them. So I think it could be a possibility.
And I think that's the model that you have to use, where you stand on the shoulders of other, or hold hands with other organisations.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to reinvent the wheel every time. That's just expensive of time and money.
But it's a tricky one because there's quite a bit of discussion about what to accredit. You know, some people want to accredit the craft, you know, the quality of your making.
Yes.
And other people want to accredit the quality of your teaching.
Yes.
And it's quite different. And we've always had a wide range of making. So it's a difficult issue for us, I think, as a sector or a movement to talk more about what do we want to accredit.
I think it's been, as someone who employs teachers, it's always been important to me that my teachers have a teaching understanding or their own
have done a teaching degree
or diploma or some sort. I've got that teaching background too, and I feel that that brings a framework that you don't get when you're just a maker. But I just think it's very helpful, a helpful one to have when you're in the teaching business, to have an understanding of education, creativity, where it comes from, how we, you know, mine's not just a blanket education background, but it's an art education background as well, which is this even other, a deeper sort of level. And I feel that that brings a passion to teaching and an understanding of education that can't otherwise be got.
That's an interesting thing with the teaching, because in universities you haven't had to have any teaching experience or qualification, but
CAFE courses,
you need research. Mm. Which is studio practice now, that's recognised as research. But with the vocational education sector, you have to have teacher training, and once you're appointed, if you haven't got teacher training, you have to undertake. I think that's actually desirable for people who want to make teaching a career, as opposed to doing a masterclass, which is a very, very different sort of thing to teaching within some kind of structured course.
And as opposed to just teaching it in your studio as well, which there's nothing wrong with that, but I think if you're going to have that professional approach, it helps to have more.
I guess the last thing that came up was some talk about the crest of the wave we seem to be on, and how do we make sure that we don't get dumped somehow. And do you have any thoughts about that?
I'm a bit of an optimist. I think that if you remain open to the fact there will always be change, and you see where there are opportunities or niches within which, I mean, you mentioned these, Lou, in your comment in the conversation today, but you can align yourself to different sectors or find niches where you can operate. There can be a multitude of different kinds of ceramic practice where you still can make in your studio, but then you are also operating within the locavore movement or the slow food movement or whatever, or whether it's industry. You know, I work with a factory in China. I'm not really interested in having product made there, but I like what that relationship affords me in terms of taking people there.
And that picks up on your original paper, Janet, when you stated quite provocatively, I thought, in one of those opening paragraphs that the model as we know it is dead. You know, having a single person operational studio. I actually wanted to get to the point of asking you whether that you thought maybe it had come full circle again, because a lot of people out here in this conference are actually surviving off making
in their own studios
and it might be back.
I don't think that can go on forever.
Yeah.
I think that will eventually run its course. And I think already there was the sound there. People were talking about the need to accredit, or how do you determine who's a better teacher, or where can you go to train? And that's the beginning of institutionalization.
I know. It could come back. We might have 35 courses again soon.
Well, hopefully we look at the past and we don't actually make that error. Or if we do have 35, that they actually cater to different sectors. They specialise because there was just replication.
But it'll come back into a changed environment, so it'll be different.
Yeah, and it always is when it comes back into a changed environment, yes.
Well, thanks very much, Jane and Janet.
It was a
wonderful facilitated session, and I think there's some really great ideas we can take forward there.
Thanks, Lou.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. Mm.